Okay, let's begin in Job 27 and the New American Standard Bible, and I'll just read verses 1 through 6. Job continued his discourse and said, "As God lives, who has taken away my right, and the Almighty who has embittered my soul, for as long as life is in me, and the breath of God is in my nostrils, my lips certainly will not speak unjustly, nor will my tongue mutter deceit. Far be it from me that I should declare you right. Till I die, I will not put away my integrity from me. I hold fast my righteousness and will not let it go. My heart does not reproach any of my days." So, in 27:1, the Bible says, Job continued his discourse. Now, I want to say a little bit about that, and I want to just ask you afterwards, just ask you to be honest. Did any of you notice, I could ask you right now, I guess. Did any of you notice that that introduction was a little different than most introductions? Did you catch on to that? Usually the word is that someone answered. Like in Job 26, verse 1, it says Job responded, but pretty much from Job 3, on, every time you get a new speaker, it has all been stated the same way. But here in 27 and verse 1, there is a distinction. He took up a discourse. And the word discourse is actually the word that is translated proverb in the book of Proverbs. You see it in Proverbs 1:1, Proverbs 1:10:1 and 25:1. And that can refer to a short statement, a short memorable statement like we have in much of Proverbs. It can refer to a much longer discourse. What Balaam spoke is spoken of as a proverb. Or it can refer to a mock or a derision, a proverb, a taunt. It's used in that way several times. So Job continued his discourse, continued his proverb. But this introduction is going to be followed in 29:1 and in 36:1. But does it make any difference that this speech is introduced a little differently? One of the things, as far as we've seen, the last speaker was Job. In 26, he answered in 26:1, and he's speaking all the way through verse 14. So we might say, why does it say he continued his discourse? Why does it introduce it as if it's something new because it's not a new speaker? It may be that the writer is signaling that this third cycle of speeches is just different than the ones that have gone previously. Remember, in the others, we've seen Eliphaz speaking and Job replying. Bildad speaking and Job replying. Zophar speaking and Job replying. And here, it may be an acknowledgement that that is missing. And Job says, "As God lives, who has taken away my right, and the Almighty who has embittered my soul." Let me just ask you up front, what do you find shocking about that statement?
Well, it appears he's blaming God for it.
He's blaming God. While at the same time, taking an oath that God lives. He is swearing by the God that he says has taken away his rights and who has embittered his soul. And that is pretty striking. Now first of all, let us think just a moment. Think about oaths in the Old Testament. We largely, when we think about oaths, we think about Jesus' statement, take no oaths at all, in Matthew 5. And I can even remember the discussion growing up often, if you were in a court of law, can you swear to tell the truth? Some of you will remember those discussions. While we say that, we do practice it a little bit. We do take oaths. We stand up before a group of people and vow to be faithful to our wife or our husband till death do us part. But in the Old Testament, they were very common. And to swear in the name of a God means that you thought that God was real and that God could punish you for wrongdoing. In Deuteronomy chapter 6 and verse 13, you shall fear only the Lord your God, and you shall worship him and swear by his name. And so in the Old Testament, to swear by the name of God, to swear by the name of God, to swear by the name of Yahweh, was a profound statement that is the God you believed in, that is the God that you believed could punish you if you weren't telling the truth. It is particularly significant when you see foreigners that vow in the Lord's name. Do you remember that widow that Elijah came to in 1 Kings 17, and he asked her for a drink of water, and she said, as the Lord your God lives, as the Lord your God lives, all I have in the house is this. She's swearing by the name of God, indicating that she believed in God. And you also see that same kind of thing in the book of Jonah, in Jonah 1 and verse 16, when the people made vows and offered sacrifices to the Lord. The Gentiles on board have changed their allegiance to the God of Israel. So to swear as God lives was to take your life in jeopardy if you spoke a falsehood. But this is what is striking about this. What is striking about this is often after one takes an oath in God's name, if there is any further discussion, it is a discussion about how God has done you good. Let me give you a couple examples. In Genesis 48, verse 16, Genesis 48, verses 15 and 16. He blessed Jacob and said, the God before whom my fathers, Abraham and Isaac, walked, the God who has been my shepherd all my life to this day, the angel who has redeemed me from all evil, bless the lads. But he's using God's name in an oath to confer promises. But you notice that he mentions God and he says, God has been my shepherd all the days of my life. And we could refer to many other examples of this. But I want to refer to 2 Samuel 4, to something that David says when man comes to him and claims, when a couple of men come and bring Ishbosheth's head and said, listen, we've killed your enemy. And David says in 2 Samuel 4 and verse 9, as the Lord lives, who has redeemed my life from all distress. So the passages we use there, Genesis 48, 15 and 16, and 2 Samuel chapter 4 and verse 9. So, generally in the Old Testament, if you see something added after this vow, as the Lord lives or as God lives, it is usually something God has done favorably for the person who is making the vow or who is praying the prayer. But that is not the case in Job 27. As God lives, who has taken away my right, taken away my right, and as the Almighty who has embittered my soul. Now, God has taken away his rights. Now, this is the first time that specific kind of statement is made, but it shouldn't surprise us because Job has claimed that if he were innocent, God would not acquit him, that if he tries to cleanse himself, God will drag him through the mud, so to speak, in Job 9, verses 28 through 31. And we found many other statements like this. God is at war with him, he pictured in Job 16 and Job 19. But as God lives, who has taken away my right, and the Almighty who has embittered my soul. The word embittered is used by Naomi when she comes back to the land of Israel. Don't call me Ruth, don't call me Naomi, but call me Mara, for the Almighty has dealt bitterly with me. And remember the woman in 2 Kings 4 who had a son, and Elisha said, "What can I do for you?" And she says, "I'm content among my people." And Gehazi says, "Her husband's old. They don't have a child." And she says, "This year, this time next year, you're going to have a son." And she says, "Oh, please don't get my hopes up." And after that son dies, remember, she goes to Elisha. And the Bible says in 2 Kings 4:27, uses the same word. Her soul was bitter. Her soul was bitter. And Elisha said, "The Lord has not told me why she is bitter." But my point is, this word is used of other people in the Bible who have expressed great loss. But to me, this is the striking thing about the book of Job. That Job, who has been shown injustice by God, is looking for justice from God. The God who has embittered his soul is the only one he can satisfy his soul. And it's something we've seen in different ways throughout the book. I don't know if I expressed that well, or if you would have something that you think could better express it. But any ideas there? But this is really the dilemma of the book. Where else is Job going to look for justice but to this God? And somehow he believes that God will give it, even though at this time his experience has been so painful. In verse 3, "As long as life is in me and the breath of God is in my nostrils, my lips will not speak unjustly, nor my tongue mutter deceit." Okay? Job is going to speak what's right. He's not going to speak deceit. He's not going to speak unjustly. What does that involve? What does that involve in this particular case? "Far be it from me, till I die, I will not put away my integrity. I will hold fast my righteousness and not let it go. My heart does not reproach any of my days." What Job is affirming so strongly as a lifelong vow, did you notice in verse 3, "As long as life is in me"? In verse 5, the phrase, till I die. He is not going to put away his integrity. He's going to hold fast to his righteousness. But what it seems to refer to in this particular account is he is not going to acknowledge sin and confess his guilt when he's not guilty. Now, we think of integrity. We think of integrity as not lying if we're guilty, acknowledging our sin and acknowledging our guilt. And that's certainly part of it, isn't it? And that's certainly part of a picture of being righteous and having integrity, that when we're guilty and we're convicted, we say so. But at the same time, if we're innocent and people are pressuring us to say we're guilty, should we say we're guilty just to appease everybody else? I knew of a situation where there erupted a big conflict between a couple of men in a congregation. As they continued to work it out and as they were helped by others and the leadership of the congregation to try to work this out, it became more and more clear where the problem was. When the person who was guilty was confronted and told that he needed to acknowledge sin, he said, well, I'll confess sin if he confesses sin. First of all, I don't know if that's much of a confession if you demand somebody else confess with you. And I can remember people asking me, and this is before I was really taking Job into consideration, but people ask, what should you do? I said, I don't see how it's honorable to confess guilt just to satisfy somebody else in that circumstance. I would believe that more strongly today because of this kind of text. Because of this passage here. Because it seems like to me that's the exact thing that Job refuses to do. Now, look at verse 4. It says, my lips will not speak unjustly, nor will my tongue mutter deceit. My lips will not speak unjustly, nor will my tongue mutter deceit. Back in 13 verse 7, Job used both of those two key words, unjust and deceit or deceitful, to talk about his friends. In 13 verse 7, will you speak what is unjust for God? And will you speak what is deceitful for him? So again, Job accused his friends of speaking unjustly. He accused his friends of being deceitful. And Job is saying here, in 27 verse 4, that he's not going to do that. My lips are not going to speak unjustly. My tongue will not mutter deceit. Job's integrity, and that word integrity in verse 5 is a key word in the book. It is a word used, or it's tied, it's the same root word as used in the very first verse where Job was blameless and upright. Job's integrity. Job is blameless. But Job's integrity in chapter 2 meant that when his wife told him, curse God and die, he wasn't going to do it. And when they're in effect saying, acknowledge your sin or die, he says, I'm not going to do it. I'm going to hold fast my righteousness and not let it go. Do you have a question right there or a thought about that? Okay, let's look at verses 7 through 12. He said, may my enemy be as the wicked, and my opponent as the unjust. For what is the hope of the godless when he is cut off? When God requires his life, will God hear his cry when distress comes upon him? Will he take delight in the Almighty? Will he call on God at all times? I will instruct you in the power of God. What is with the Almighty, I will not conceal. Behold, all of you have seen it. Why then do you act so foolishly? Okay, looking at this particular term, enemy, Job says in verse 3, may my enemy be as the wicked, my enemy and my opponent as the unjust. Who would the enemy be there?
The friends.
Seems like to me, David, that's right. One of the reasons I wanted to mention it is because there are places in the book where God has been viewed as the enemy. And in some of those, God has been viewed as the enemy. In 13:24, in 16:9, in 19:11, in all of those passages, God is viewed as the enemy. Some make a big point of the fact that the term enemy is used in the singular here. And some writers will even think that he's making reference to God, that God is his enemy and my opponent be as the unjust. But you don't find any example in the Old Testament of calling down curses upon God. You find people calling upon God to curse someone. You don't find them calling down curses upon him. You don't find that. And that doesn't fit for even though Job has accused God of taking away his rights and embittering his soul, he still believes in God. He knows his only hope against God is God. And that's why he swears in God's name. And so he's not talking about the God here. He the only explanation that really makes sense that he's speaking about the friends. Sometimes he speaks of them in plural, and sometimes he speaks of them in singular. But that makes sense because they're all saying basically the same thing. And in a sense, he says, may the enemy be like the wicked. It's also hard to say these are the words of the friends, they've been misplaced, and they're speaking this against Job, because Job already is experiencing what the wicked person experiences. In the Old Testament, let's say I was a witness against you in a crime, and I stood up and gave testimony against you, false testimony against you. And if I gave false testimony against you and it is discovered that I'm dishonest, that I'm lying in that process, what was the penalty that I received for giving false testimony? Do you remember?
Death,
wasn't it? Okay, not automatically. It could be. Yeah, whatever the penalty would have been, it could be a capital offense if it was a capital crime that I was bearing witness in. But depending on what the offense would have gotten, that's what I received for falsely accusing another. And you read about that. You read about that in Deuteronomy 19. Verses 15 through 21. Now, why do I bring that up at this point? It may be that as Job is speaking here, he said, you have accused me of being wicked. You have accused me of being sinful, of being an enemy, of being an opponent of God. And the penalty that he is expressing that would come upon them, or asking come upon them, would be the penalty they would have received that he would receive, that they said he would receive for being a wicked person. Did I say that well? That the penalty that he is calling upon them to receive is the penalty they would have received, that he would have received if he had been a guilty person. And they said, if you're guilty, all these things will happen. But he says, may my enemy be as the wicked, my opponent as the unjust. For verse 8, what is the hope of the godless when he is cut off, when God requires his life? What is the hope of the godless? And it says in verse 9, will God hear his cry when distress comes upon him? Now, let me make a little tangent here. I don't want to get too far astray, but some of you probably heard the same thing or had the same thought. I can remember the debate when I was growing up about, does God ever hear the prayer of a non-Christian? Some of you will remember that. God ever hear the prayer of a non-Christian. And I can remember often preaching that no, he doesn't. And certainly there are verses that you can give that can indicate that, for example, he who turns away his ear from the hearing of his law, even his prayer is an abomination to God. In Proverbs 29, verse 8. And you have another passage I remember I like to quote in that discussion. Psalm 66, 18. If I regard iniquity in my heart, the Lord will not hear me. So there are a lot of passages that said that. The problem, of course, was there are cases where you see God answering a prayer of someone who isn't in a covenant with him. Particularly in the New Testament, the example that really made me think was Cornelius. When God tells him, your prayer's heard, I mean, God knows what he's talking about right there. And God says, your prayer is heard. But the thing is, it's not that God never hears the prayer of a person not in covenant with him. Even the book of Jonah, apparently God is hearing the prayers that those people offer after throwing Jonah overboard. But does the Bible show us, does the Bible contain many statements that God will not hear our prayer if we live in defiance to him? It says that in the Old Testament and in the New Testament, doesn't it? So it's not that that idea didn't have a principle behind it. And also, I'll tell you what we were guarding against. We were guarding against the idea that the non-Christian can be saved by praying the sinner's prayer. Which again, it's a right point. It's a right point that we're guarding against there. But Job asked, will God hear his cry? If a person doesn't listen to God, if a person's wicked, will God hear his cry when distress comes upon him? And the answer that Job is expecting to verse 9 in context is no. God's not going to hear his cry. He's not going to hear his cry when distress comes on him. In verse 10, will he take delight in the Almighty? And this particular word, delight, is used when Psalm 37 verse 4 calls for us to delight ourselves in the Lord. Psalm 37 verse 4. And this word delight was used previously by Eliphaz in Job 22 and verse 26 when he encouraged Job, then you will delight in the Almighty and lift up your face to God. And so Job is saying, he's asking these questions, expecting to know, what is his hope When he's cut off, when God requires his life, verse 8. Verse 9, will God hear his cry when distress comes upon him? And will he take delight in the Almighty? Will he call upon God at all times? In other words, is this wicked person going to simply cry out in the moment of distress and then forget all about God? Or is he going to call on God as a regular course, as a common activity in his life? And so Job, I think, speaking to his friends, saying, you realize the seriousness of God's judgment upon the wrongdoer. And in verse 11, I will instruct you in the power of God. What is with the Almighty, I will not conceal. The word power of God is actually the hand of God. And often in the book of Job, Job has spoken of God's hand being against him. In Job 10, verse 7, as an example, according to your knowledge, I am indeed not guilty, yet there is no deliverance from your hand. The hand of God has often been oppressive on Job. He said, I will instruct you in the power of God, in the hand of God. And what is it? What is with the Almighty, I will not conceal. Now, I think what this is saying, the friends throughout the book have acted as if they knew better than Job who God is, what God does, and they understood God better. And they have claimed a kind of a ground of moral superiority and intellectual superiority in talking about who God is. Job says, I'm going to talk to you about who God is. I'm going to talk to you about his hand, about his power, about what is true of the Almighty. And in verse 12, behold, all of you have seen it. Why do you act foolishly? Now, do any of you have a different translation for that word foolishly in verse 12? Why do you act foolishly? David?
We've got a footnote that says, speak vanity.
Okay, speak vanity. Speak vanity. Any of the rest, what translation was that?
Well, it's a footnote in the New American Standard.
Okay.
But
I have the LSB and it says, speak with utter vanity.
Utter vanity. Okay. Ruth?
New King James Version says, why then do you behave with complete nonsense?
Complete nonsense, okay.
The ESV says, why then have you become altogether vain?
Okay, altogether vain. Were you going to say something?
I was just going to say my version says the same thing.
Okay.
It's not in the version.
All of these, but the word you will recognize. This word that's translated foolishness or nonsense, it is the word used in the book of Ecclesiastes to translate vanity of vanities. All is vanity. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. And actually, there are two forms of this word that are used here back to back. That's why it would say sometimes it's utter nonsense. And what did you say, Mark? You were saying?
It was utter vanity.
Utter vanity. Utter nonsense. It's the idea that there are two forms of this same word used together. But it also is a question. What is he talking? And this is something that makes the book of Job difficult. There are a lot of things that make the book of Job difficult. What is he talking about that you've all seen it? And why are you speaking vanity, or why are you acting foolish? What's he talking about that they all know better than they do, than they're saying they do?
Would it be the power or the hand of God?
Okay. It could be Micah. Now, that is in context. I will say that that answer is better in context than the answer that I was thinking. But I think that maybe what he's saying, that they have spoken foolishness and spoken vanity, is when they act as if the righteous never suffer and the wicked never prosper. He has dealt with that at other points in the book. Now, granted, he doesn't deal with it directly in this context, like the point that Micah made. But I do think, I mean, how can we, like, would any of us make the observation, some of the observations that the friends make in the book by our experience in the world? Would any of us say, oh, the wicked is always going to be brought down. The righteous is always going to be blessed, and we're always going to see it in this life. Would we ever make those affirmations? And Job is saying, you know better than that. If my interpretation is correct. You know better than that. Why are you speaking such foolishness or such nonsense? You see the point that I'm trying to suggest what he's... But it is difficult to tell sometimes when he says, all of you have seen it. Why do you act so foolishly? What is under discussion right here? Any more questions that you have right there? David?
I was just going to comment on the last thing you were saying. Ultimately, the righteous will be blessed. Not necessarily in this life.
Yes.
And ultimately, the wicked will be brought down.
Yes.
It's not necessarily.
Yeah. Sometimes you see writers on the book of Job who will say Job is disputing the idea of retribution. And they define retribution like you're saying. The righteous will be blessed. The wicked will suffer. Job is not disputing the idea of retribution. Job is just saying that you don't always see it worked out in this world. And that's part, in the book of Job helps us wrestle with that. Do we sometimes see God's judgment on the wicked and God's judgment on sinners? Do we sometimes see that worked out in life? I mean, I can think of so many people I grew up with who got involved early in very dangerous things and very sinful practices that we were often warned about, this can take your life, this can destroy you. And a lot of them have lost their life. A lot of them have already passed away. And I know that one day my son Nathan had called me. And well, this was a few years ago. And he realized that's already true of some people he knew growing up. But they've already passed away. People who had a lot of athletic ability and a good personality, but became captive to drugs and alcohol. And it cost them everything. So sometimes we see it worked out in this life. But do you see other people for whom it works out in this life that they have all kinds of good things living in utter rebellion to God? And sometimes it works out that when you're righteous and you do what's right and you listen to God and you live an appropriate lifestyle, that sometimes you avoid all kinds of trouble. And sometimes you don't. And Job is not trying to argue that the wicked never suffer in this life or the righteous are never blessed in this life, but he does say it's foolish to act like that never happens. I think that's part of what he is saying. Any more thoughts on that? Mark?
Yeah, I wonder if you can comment about.
Okay.
I think viewing that as God is problematic with, especially at the beginning of the book, where the accuser says, take these things away from him, he'll curse God.
Yes.
I don't think Job ever curses God.
No.
In this. Anywhere.
He's
calling down a curse on his enemies. If you see God as the enemy here, then he'd be calling down a curse on him. So I do think Job speaks at certain points in time and repents of that. But I don't think he ever curses God.
That's a good point to make, and really I hadn't thought about that, is that if God was the enemy he's speaking of, this is in effect cursing God. And I had not thought about it that way. But that is a good point. And so, I think it is very problematic to see that as a reference to God. Now, I want to tell you, I'm sitting here, and I've been wrestling with this all day. I've been, and I know this might be a little bit overdramatic to wrestle with this all day, but I have been. Okay, I don't know if we're going to have enough time to finish the chapter. But I do want to at least say a couple things and have you look for these things for next time. First of all, I want to read verses 13 through 23. We want to read it. What is the problem? And ask you the question, what is the problem with this in the context of the book of Job? And tell you some things to look for, okay? 27, 13 through 23. This is the portion of a wicked man from God, and the inheritance which tyrants receive from the Almighty. Though his sons are many, they are destined for the sword, and his descendants will not be satisfied with bread. His survivors will be buried because of the plague, and their widows will not be able to weep. Though he piles up silver like dust, and he prepares garments as plentiful as clay, he may prepare it, but the just will wear it, and the innocent will divide the silver. And he has built his house like a spider's web, or as a hut which the watchman has made. He lies down rich, but never again. He opens his eyes, and it is no more. Terrors overtake him like a flood. A tempest steals him away in the night. The east wind carries him away, and he is gone. For it whirls away from his place. For whirls him away from his place. Verse 22. It will hurl at him without sparing. He will surely try to flee from its power. Men will clap their hands at him and will hiss him from his place. Now, in this passage, and you may not, if you don't grasp what I'm hitting at, you may even be offended by the question. Okay? But what is the problem with these words? What's the problem with those words?
Speaking for God?
Okay. He's speaking for God. That's a problem or... Okay. Elaborate, Gary.
Well, he's stating these things as if he knows the way God thinks and operates, and he's stating them as facts. This is...
Okay. I think you're saying the same thing that I'm thinking. But, David, we'll come back to that, Gary. What were you saying?
He's sounding a lot like his friend.
Okay, I think that's the same thing Gary was saying, that this sounds more like the friends than Job. It sounds more like the friends than it does like Job. For example, like 27:14. Then his sons are many, and they are destined for the sword. And his descendants will not be satisfied with bread. His sons are going to die by the sword. They're going to die by famine. Is that what Job has said throughout the book? Or is that more something like the friends have said? It sounds more like the friends have said. So this is what I would encourage you to do for next time, okay? And I apologize if we're breaking this down too much, because I know that people usually don't complain. This has been my experience in 47 or so years of preaching. People usually don't complain about getting out a minute or two early. It's not so much that I'm worried about. It's not that I'm worried, but I just want to make sure we're covering enough to justify you coming here. But I want you to do this. Look for some places. The friends said the same kind of thing that Job is saying here. Same kind of thing that Job is saying right here. Where are some places that is the case? Then, also something to look for is places where Job has said almost the opposite. So look for places the friends have said the kind of things Job is saying here. Look for places where Job has said things that were almost diametrically opposed to this. And then also look for places, and it doesn't have to be necessarily in this order, okay? But look for places where the things that are said here happened to Job. And so I would encourage you, look for those three things. And you know also, we're going to try to see, as we get to the end of the chapter, is how we fit this all through the lens of the whole Bible and looking at Jesus too. But next time, Lord willing, we want to look at each of those things. Places where the friends said the same kind of things that Job is saying in 27:13-23, places where Job has said the opposite, and places where these are the kind of things that happen to Job. And then after we do that, we want to ask again, just like we did in 24, how do we explain this? How do we explain this? What does it mean? And I will tell you this. I tend to look at this case in Job 27, verses 13 through 23, a little differently than I did the case in 24, 18 through 25. I think there may be a little bit of something different that is at play here. Okay. Everybody understands your homework, understands your assignment. Please not over 10 pages in your paper that you turn in for class next time. Lord willing, we will not meet next Tuesday night. I was supposed to be speaking in Alabama, and we will try to speak. We will try to meet in a couple of weeks. And I apologize if it's too little to cover, but we're just going to try to cover that and have to cover 28 in the class after that. But thank you for being here. Thank you for your interest and your desire to learn the book of Job. The thing that strikes me most is I think that, and I don't know if I always express it well, and I don't know that I've expressed it well in covering this book, but I think the thing that sticks with me most tonight is how we sometimes believe in hope against hope. Job talked about how God had taken away his rights and embittered him, and yet at the same time, that's where he trusted. And in a certain sense, I think we all live that way. We can't figure out why God is doing certain things, and yet we know that somehow he's got the answer. But thank you for being here. And Gary, would you want to lead us in prayer as we close?
Sure. Dear God and Father in heaven above, we humbly come before thee once again. We're ever so thankful that you've made it possible for us to be part of you once again, that you... We have comfort in knowing that you will hear our prayers when we practice righteousness and seek to do thy will in all things. And know that when we fall short, that we can ask for forgiveness and that you will do so. We're thankful for the time we spend in this precious time and studying this to come together as an extra study on Tuesday nights to help us to better understand Job and his friends. Job has so many dilemmas and heartfelt nagging pains that he wished someone could answer for him. And sometimes he seems to contradict himself in saying that his salvation is in you, and he looks to you for hope and for salvation. And then other times he just feels like you've abandoned him and you've put him under the microscope and have been torturing him. Help us when we find ourselves in these kind of situations here on this earth, Father. Help us to be strong in our faith and to know that we may not always have the answers or know why things happen to us here on this earth, but we do know for certainty, Father, through your sacrifice of your Son, that you love us more than we can comprehend, and that you want what's best for us. You've made a way for us, and you've shown us the way home and given us that secure hope. And we're ever so thankful for all of these things, Father. In your Son, bless the name we pray.
Amen.